On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Apple's EFI has been torn asunder. NVIDIA has got the perfect graphics part for your data center. Net neutrality is being attacked on multiple fronts. And ExtraHop wants to give your network more smarts. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 259, recorded September 29th, 2017. ExtraHop, machine learning for network management. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, starting with Mr. Lou Maresca, freshly ignited back from Orlando. Mr. Maresca, how was your time over at the big show?
You know what? We had a really successful week. Lots of product announcements and some cool stuff. And I think my sessions went pretty well.
Yes, and of course, you can see our TD is having fun with your lower third. You are now senior booth babe. You have been promoted. I think that entitles you to a corner office and the keys to the company jet. So congratulations, sir. Oh, by the way, you did meet up with Mary Jo and Paul, did you not?
I did. I ran into them at their meetup, and man, it was crowded there. So I didn't get to talk to them for too long, but it was great seeing them.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you back, and it's good to have you plugged in. Hopefully, you can give us a few insights about the show. Also joining us, of course, is my good friend Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. And again, he is melting, folks, because he still does not have air conditioning. Let me tell you, the islands get super hot. Let me see if I can say this properly. How's it, brah?
It's hot. It's really hot.
You know, at some point, we're just going to have to give you a better sound filter and let you sit in the data center, because I don't like this whole idea of, throughout the show, I just see you fanning yourself.
Actually, I've got one of those Madonna headset microphones.
you want to try that next time?
That's right. Okay. I just got to clean up so that we can get the air conditioner hoist in here and the guys can go and pull out the window air conditioner and fix it. I'm basically done. I've had a request to substitute the window for a split system so it'd be quiet. I've had that request in for almost 15 years. And the unit that I bought that's in storage has died because it's just sat there rotting. So I'm done with that.
I've got a spare one here in San Francisco if you want to pay me a visit.
You know, hey, I'm just going to build a studio that looks and functions well when I hit Orlando. Bottom line.
That's a plan. Well, gentlemen, we've got quite the show for the TWiET Riot. Not only do we have to talk a little bit about some enterprise news, some security issues, as well as net neutrality, because yes, folks, it is back in the news. But we've got some special guests from ExtraHop. Wouldn't you like to get real-time line speed information out of your network? Well, they're going to show you how. But first, as we always do, we need to kick it off with the blips. Now, Apple has done a truly admirable job of securing their hardware and software against the most obvious venues of exploit, walking well that fine line between demanding better security practices out of their users and annoying them with lockdown hardware. For the most part, it's been working. Apple gear, though not invulnerable, has stayed away from being the lowest hanging fruit and therefore avoided the pitfalls of being an easy target with a huge exploit service. However, a security firm by the name of Duo may have just found Apple's Achilles heel, and it has big ramifications for the enterprise BYOD market. Duo has spent the past few months digging through 74,000 Apple computers and found that while the OS is almost always updated past critical vulnerabilities, the EFI, or extensible firmware, is not. According to their research, once they narrowed their study to the 54,000 machines that were still new enough to be actively maintained by Apple, almost half of certain models of laptops and desktops, because of technical glitches or slow updates, don't have an updated EFI, the basic instructions that tell the computer how to boot into the OS. Furthermore, there's an entire subset of models for which Apple has never released an EFI update, leaving a large number of Apple machines vulnerable to EFI attacks that have been in the wild for years. More troubling is the fact that it seems Apple's EFI updating routine is buggy at best, installing the wrong EFI on 4.2% of laptops and desktops. For example, 43% of the 21.5-inch versions of the 2015 iMac had the wrong EFI, as did 25 to 35% of 2016 MacBook Pros. It should be noted that this isn't just an Apple problem. EFI vulnerabilities can strike across platforms. However, the closed nature of Apple's ecosystem means it's more of an issue as an advanced persistent threat.
Well, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai calls on Apple to stop disabling the FM radio chips on iPhones. This is actually the first thing that the new FCC chair has done that I actually agree with. But considering how manufacturers like Qualcomm have started deprecating the FM radio circuits, I wonder whether it's a little too little too late. Also considering that the updated article from Ars Technica has the official Apple response along with the same lines, indicating that maybe Chairman Pai is getting his information a bit late in the game. The update reads, Apple cares deeply about the safety of our users, especially during times of crisis, and that's why we have engineered modern safety solutions into our products. Users can dial emergency services and access medical ID card information directly from the lock screen, and we enable government emergency notifications, ranging from weather advisories to Amber Alerts. iPhone 7 and iPhone 8 models do not have FM radio chips in them, nor do they have antennas designed to support FM signals, so it is not possible to enable FM reception in those products.
So safe and efficient telecommunication systems have been a pretty good focus of the good part of the telecom industry to date. But just today, there was a huge leap forward with the first ever quantum safe video conference, which was held between President of the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing and the President of the Austria Academy of Sciences in Vienna. It was the first real-world demonstration of intercontinental quantum communications. What sets apart from the normal conventional secured video systems today, while the traditional public key cryptography can rely on the perceived computational insolvability of certain mathematical functions. But in contrast, quantum key distribution, or QKD, uses individual light quanta, or single photons, in quantum superposition states to guarantee unconditional security throughout the system. This trustful relay can actually eventually connect to any two points on the earth for high security key exchange. Well, how is this achieved? Well, the Chinese Academy of Sciences spent more than 10 years in developing a sophisticated satellite named Micius, equipped with three payloads, a decoy state QKD transmitter, an entangled photon source, and a quantum and teleportation receiver and analyzer. Historically, quantum communication distances were held and limited to just a few kilometers due to the channel loss of fibers or terrestrial free space. But by exploiting space in itself based on a link system, it can actually connect Earth-based points together with reduced channel loss because of the most of the photon propagation path is empty space, which means there's no negligible loss in quantum decoherence. Just think, sometime soon, you might have a FaceTime or Skype quantum video call.
From the future of networking to the past. Now, security is hard. We know this. And as we watch company after company failing to protect their treasure troves of super sensitive data, one technology from the past is making a comeback. Tape. Rob Pritchard, an associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute and founder of a security consulting firm, has watched as tape backups have slowly returned to being an attractive option for enterprises looking for a way to both backup and secure their data. While cloud or network backup solutions are faster and more convenient, nearline solutions like tape have increasingly been adopted as a data storage option that offers better pricing than cloud, more reliability than network hard drives, and far more security than either. With some tape technologies able to hold up to 15 terabytes per unit, a physical robustness unrivaled by modern solutions, and as close to bulletproof security as you can get with their nearline storage, tape vendors are adopting a mantra that would have been nonsensical in the 80s and 90s. They're touting the fact that tape is inconvenient, and inconvenient in this age is usually more secure.
Well, Netflix is dropping some serious coin on Canadian production houses. Netflix will create a permanent production presence outside of the United States for the first time with the establishment of Netflix Canada and a pledge to put over $400 million towards the development of Canadian programming. The money will be spent over the course of 5 years. The streaming service has largely avoided the requirements put on Canadian content producers by the country's government. That has ushered in concerns over loss of Canadian content, worries over how to compete with streaming services, and calls for streaming taxes. However, the money from which has been proposed should go to Canadian to fund Canadian programming. Canada briefly had its own Netflix rival, ShowMe, but it went kaput last year. As of now, the country doesn't tax digital companies like Netflix and doesn't plan to anytime soon. Considering the amount of U.S. shows now produced in Canada already, this could mean that the streaming version of Hollywood is going north of the border. Well, maybe now I can get my episodes of Murdoch Mysteries sooner.
Could the FDA be warming up to modern technology? Well, to add to their trend, yesterday the FDA just approved their first ever continuous blood sugar monitor that doesn't require the user to prick themselves over and over for a blood sample. What is cool about you ask? Well, the Abbott's Freestyle Libre Flash Glucose Monitoring System is a device that uses a small sensor wire inserted under the skin to determine glucose levels in adult diabetics. Another wand-like device is then waved over the sensor to measure and give a readout of those glucose levels. This new device can positively impact more than 30 million people just in the U.S. to date. Even though the idea of prickless blood sugar detector is not new, there have been some others that have been approved, but they were found to be cumbersome and hard to use. This device works for 18-year-olds and older and has a 12-hour startup period, but can be worn for over 10 days straight. The FDA's new model of helping people and making it convenient for an industry could be helpful for both investors and innovators alike.
Now, last week, the Silicon buzz was all about AMD's wins with Tesla, the car manufacturer, and OEMs with their Ryzen architecture. This week, NVIDIA fires back with a big push to get their Volta chips into hyperscale data centers. At the Strata Data Conference in New York this Wednesday, four manufacturing giants, IBM, Dell EMC, Supermicro, and HP Enterprise, announced that they're using NVIDIA's Tesla V100 GPUs. This is in addition to Lenovo, Huawei, and Isper, who earlier announced that they'd be using NVIDIA's HGX architecture for their data center products. This is big news for NVIDIA, who owns about 70% of the discrete GPU market and is making a case for itself in the machine learning and mass analytics workspace with the 21 billion transistors and 5,120 CUDA cores of the V100. But it's not all about hardware. NVIDIA has also been developing software like its TensorRT optimizing compiler to make it easier to use their massively parallel chips in machine learning and AI applications. That does it for the blips. Next up, it's the bites. And yes, folks, it's a doozy. Get ready for some net neutrality. But before we get there, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode of Twilight is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. You know this. It was dated and it needed a client-focused technological revolution, something past papers and boxes filled with receipts. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. No more dragging in all of your old pay stubs to prove that you're actually worthy of a loan. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and then help you find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, we have to jump back to this. I know there's a collective groan every time we have to address this subject, but unfortunately it is big in the news right now, and you're going to see that there's actually something that our listeners and our viewers can do to help the situation. Because, yep, we're going back to net neutrality. Now let's get back to some of the basic facts just so we can set the playing field for our discussion. Net neutrality regulations were enacted in 2015 by the FCC. This was in parallel to a reclassification of ISPs from service providers to utilities. Now, of course, the reason why ISPs had to be reclassified was because when the FCC tried to keep them from blocking competing services, the ISPs sued the FCC and the courts agreed with the ISPs, but specifically told them that the FCC did not have the power to regulate a service provider. However, it did have the power to reclassify those service providers as utilities. That was well within the purview of the FCC. And so that's what it did. Under Chairman Wheeler, the FCC reclassified ISPs as utilities and then had a huge stick with which to beat them. However, true to his word, Wheeler did not use it. Not once has the FCC come out and used that title to demand that the ISPs do the right thing. In fact, they've been sort of saying, look, as long as you do the right thing, we're light touch. Just make sure you keep your networks open. Make sure that you are friendly to competition. Make sure you're doing right by the consumers, and we'll never, ever have to punish you. Well, that's all changed. With the new FCC, now led by Ajit Pai, there's a different FCC in town. The FCC originally didn't want Comcast to block Netflix, making Comcast own streaming service a monopoly by peering, and that's really what it was about. But this FCC is all about building out infrastructure. And they're making the argument that the only way to build out infrastructure is to remove regulation. The first thing that this new FCC did was to announce that it wanted to reverse the reclassification, to reclassify the reclassifications. Furthermore, they wanted to put into Congress a way to stop the reclassification from happening again once the political winds shift. Now, this would have put the ISPs under the legal jurisdiction of the already grossly overtaxed FTC. And the reason that they give for the reclassification is the time-honored talking point, which is net neutrality discourages investment. Fast forward just a little bit more. Just this past week, the ISPs themselves have had a go. In fact, they've brought it all the way up to the Supreme Court. According to Bloomberg, AT&T and a host of other ISPs have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn net neutrality rules outright, not waiting for the FCC, not waiting for a reclassification. Now, AT&T, in its brief, suggested that net neutrality, quote, fundamentally transforms the internet and will have a staggering impact on infrastructure investment, unquote. Once again, parroting FCC Chairman Ajit Pai. But folks, here's the thing. It's difficult to sell the idea that we need to kill net neutrality because certain ISPs deserve a monopoly on the services that can be used over their utilities. So instead, they've wrapped themselves in the blanket of net neutrality kills an investment. And unfortunately for them, that's just not what the numbers show. While AT&T, the FCC, and the other ISPs claim that net neutrality hurts capital investment, the numbers show that it had quite the opposite. AT&T, Charter, Comcast, Verizon, they all increased their capital outlay post-net neutrality. Here are hard numbers. AT&T, in 2014, they spent $18 billion on capital expenses. In 2016, that went up to $22 billion. Charter, from $16.6 billion in 2014 to $22.13 billion in 2016. Comcast, from $7.4 billion in 2014 to $13.9 billion in 2016. TWC, from $4.1 billion in 2014 to almost $8 billion in 2016. And Verizon, from $17.2 billion in 2014 to $17.7 billion in 2016. Now, with that playing field set, I want to throw it over to my host, Chibert. Let's start with the basics. Why now? The FCC is already ISP-friendly. Why push this to the Supreme Court when, by all means, it looks like the FCC is already going to overturn the net neutrality regulations?
First off, oh, man, I've got whiplash from this back-and-forth movement. Now, my personal opinion is I think the ISPs are seeing the writing on the wall. they don't think our friend Donald Trump is going to be in office for a second term. And it's probably going to be a campaign promise of the next president to sweep all those changes out from under, you know, what Trump did. And it's going to whip right on back. So the ISPs want it so that they can't be changed. They like the atmosphere. They don't want it to change with the next administration. And they know it's going to take some time.
Lou, what do you think? Do you buy that? Is this sort of just, well, let's strike while the iron is hot. We have to, as long as we've got a friendly court, we've got a friendly executive and legislative branch, let's do as much as we can to make it difficult for these to be reversed in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're trying to fight the fight that they can win, and they think that they can win this at this point in time. And so why not strike at the easiest, weakest point and, you know, put as much money as you can into it and hope in the future that it holds a better future for them. So I think that they're, as a corporation, they're doing it right. Whether it's right for the rest of the internet, you know, that's obviously a good discussion we're having. And I think, you know, but as a corporation, they're actually doing the right thing, putting the running money in the right spot at this point in time.
I'm glad that you brought it up. As a corporation, they are doing the right thing. I do not want to frame this as, oh, AT&T and ISPs are evil, FCC is evil. These are just different philosophies on how you encourage investment. But that brings up the next question, which is, the one talking point that has been consistent throughout the last 8 years, through the battle for net neutrality up to now, has been, well, if you enact net neutrality, you kill investment. And that's, doesn't matter what your political affiliation is, that's always, oh yeah, that's bad. We want the ISPs to invest money. We need them to invest money because we want them to improve the infrastructure. We want them to keep investing to make sure that we stay competitive. However, as I just went over the numbers, that's a lie. It's not just a lie. It's a bold-faced lie. Those numbers are available to everyone. And yet, there is not a single Senate hearing. There is not a single public call for comment. There is not a single public speech by FCC Chairman Ajit Pai in which he doesn't say net neutrality has killed investment. So how can they keep getting away saying the same thing that we know is wrong? Lou, what's your call?
You know, so, you know, it's one of those things that they're trying to go on. They try to fight on the common sense of it. They try to say that if you enact these things in the future, it will prevent us from doing any type of additional work because we end up having to, you know, pay more for infrastructure costs and other things where, you know, where if we just had the ability to charge more for specific scenarios, then we could focus that money on, you know, bettering our network. And so, you know, they're trying to create these nebulous statements that make it seem like they're being heard or hurt in some way, when in fact we know for a fact that competition enhances innovation. And so, they can keep saying it until we're deaf. But, you know, I think most people are seeing through most of it.
Hopefully. Well, Cheever, what about that? Are most people seeing through it? Because, I mean, the fact that they're willing to keep saying it means they think people believe it. Or let's actually give them the benefit of the doubt. Is there a way, anyway, for these numbers to have been misinterpreted? I mean, I can show, because they have to publicly report how much they're spending on capital outlay, that they've spent more between 2014 and 2016, and it looks like it's going to rise again in 2017. But is there a way to look at that and say, okay, it looks like they're spending more money, but we've actually slowed the pace of investment?
You know, I would love to say that they can't be misinterpreted and all this. No. The reality is John Q. Public doesn't like reading numbers. That's the bottom line. And they're going to believe what the talking heads are going to say. So it's really our duty as fellow talking heads that we need to read the numbers for people. And we need to bring them into the light. And we need to go and have a call for our viewers to go and call the representatives and say, hey, this is BS. We really like net neutrality, and that could you please not let the ISPs go and make the change permanently? This is not a lie. This is just squirrel, you know. That's okay. Literally what it is.
Right. And actually, I can do a callback to last week. We covered in one of the blips that right now the FCC is trying to let some of the broadband providers off the hook. Remember, in order to get their positions, in order to get the rights of way, in order for Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, Time Warner Cable to get where they are today, they essentially had to sign a contract with the American people saying we will extract profit from this investment. However, we will deploy for the betterment of the communities that we serve. That's actually in the act from 1986, the Cable Act. However, along with that was, well, we're going to deploy to rural areas. We're going to make sure that we push the network out to places where it doesn't currently exist. We're going to make sure that we compete. The SEC is letting them off the hook because it's now conflating wired and wireless. And it's saying in those rural areas, if there's a cell provider that can provide at least 1 megabit per second of connectivity, then we can count that as served and you don't have to deploy there. That's another one of those stories that kind of snuck under the radar. The Twilight Riot knows about it, but I haven't seen any reporting about that in the larger media. And it's almost like we're going to give away as much as we possibly can before we get voted out of office. Chiebert, have you seen that? I mean, has that made the nightly news? I don't watch news, but I'd love to hear at least once a newscaster say, oh, yeah, by the way, a bunch of stuff that we were supposed to get from the ISPs, we're not going to get it anymore.
Yeah, the funny part is I haven't seen it on any of the mainstream news. I actually haven't even seen it on the Internet Press Guild.
Wow.
That surprises me.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Lou, let's go a little bit deeper into this because, again, people are going to say, oh, because they're bought, because they're bribed. I don't think so. I've met FCC Chairman Ajit Pai. He is an honorable man. He is an educated man. I think he's misguided in his principles. I think... what he believes is that if you open it up to competition, then the competition will serve. But he's not taking into account the fact that there's no competition. Each of these ISPs basically competes in its own market with itself. But is there a way to look at the story and say, okay, well, this is just the pendulum. We're swinging back and forth. And right now we're going back to a bit more corporation friendly. And then it's going to swing back. Or is this time to panic?
I think it's time for people to put their money where their mouth is and start to push back. I think it's time. I wouldn't say time to panic, but I would say it's time to start putting in actions and actually moving forward on things.
Yeah. Okay. One last tidbit before we move on, because I do want to make sure our guests get all the time that they deserve. And that is right now, folks, you may not have heard about this because there's been a lot of other stuff in the news. But Ajit Pai is actually up for reconfirmation right now. He has to go through the process in order to get another term. And right now you can call your representative. In fact, there are several sites out there that will call your representative for you. One is called thebattleforthenet.com. If you just put in your phone number, it will automatically connect you to your representative. It even gives you a little script to say something along the lines of, I am concerned about net neutrality. I'm concerned that my utilities are being given away to companies that are going to jack up the rates on me. I'm concerned that I won't be able to get the content that I should be able to get because Comcast or Verizon or Sprint or AT&T are going to make me buy their services. So if you are in any way, shape, or form concerned with net neutrality, now is a good time to call and say, look, maybe Ajit Pai is not the man to lead us into the next century. All right, gentlemen. Let's go ahead and put that to bed because now we have to get to my favorite part of the show. And that's when we bring in some outside experts to drop knowledge on the Twilight Riot. I welcome back to the show, Mr. Sam Richman, Samuel, I know my Sam, and Matt Cawthorn. They are both from ExtraHop. Sam, of course, is a security systems engineer, and Matt is the VP of sales and engineering. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Now, I don't know who wants to take this question, but for the folks playing along at home, how would you describe your company? What is it that you do? What is it that you make? If they were to look right now and try to look for ExtraHop, what would they find?
So, Sam, I'll take this one. We're a platform for wired data analytics. And what that means is we take the data off of the network statefully, the data in flight, and we surface real-time analysis in ways that were almost impossible to do before. At modern scale, cloud, hybrid cloud, on-prem. We don't sort of discriminate. If it hits the wire, we can run analysis on it. And so that's what we are. That's a very sort of high level picture of it. And the thing that makes us different is our ability to, in real time, replay byte streams, the actual packets. We replay them statefully as if we were like an inline stateful firewall, even though we're out of band, like a traditional legacy sniffer would be deployed. And so what that allows us to do is replay the state of the network and the transactions that traversed the network in real time. It has huge implications for security, performance management, capacity planning, and much more.
Now, okay, that sounds good as a blurb, and that's definitely something that I think most of our audience will understand. Analytics good, security good, intelligence good. But what makes ExtraHop any different from at least a dozen companies that I can think of right now that say they do the same thing? They've got probes on different parts of the network. They're looking at streams. They're looking at traffic. They're plugging it into machine intelligence. What is it that ExtraHop has that no one else does? What is it that you think is your secret sauce?
The secret sauce is the stateful stream reassembly. Historically, the way the problem has been approached is you write the packets to disk. You grab the packets, you tap the network, you run a span port, and you write those packets to disk. And at some point in modern networks, computer science says no. You know, it starts to buckle under its own weight. There's so many packets to sift through. And what happens is, given the traditional packet capture model, you're sort of retroactively looking backwards in time, querying the packets themselves against some index, presumably, and then fetching them and reassembling the state. And what we find and what we see is that modern environments require much less sort of latency and much less friction in that process. Some of the competitors in the space measure their sort of time to insight in, you know, many minutes sometimes, 10 minutes, sometimes more, depending on the query. If you get the query wrong for the packets, you have to re-ask the question in another way. And what we do is we statefully reassemble in memory, in real time, and then flush the metrics themselves into the data store in a streaming real-time index. So it's a very, very novel approach. You know, I'm not sure if I mentioned this last time, but the inventors of the modern application delivery controller, the modern day application delivery controller from F5 Networks, invented our stuff. And all of that sort of network-centric yet application-fluent and scale, you know, capable domain expertise made its way into our approach in the legacy network performance management and diagnostic space, and increasingly the network traffic analysis, the NTA space in security.
Right, right. And actually, I'm glad that you brought up F5. And Sam, I want to go over to you for this one because, again, great buzzwords. Intelligence is good. The fact that we are moving away from the forensic model, which is a week later, we can figure out what happened, to right. The more immediate, we've got a pane of glass. This is what's happening on your network right now. This is actionable intelligence right now. Sam, how does that work? How do you do that? How are you analyzing all the streams that might be running through my network?
Well, that really is the secret sauce, is the ability to ingest traffic at scale and parse every protocol, basically every data center protocol at the same time. And that really is how we do it. So we can ingest at line speed 40 gigabits of traffic and parse out down to the transaction level every single protocol that's speaking and discover what they are and what devices are speaking it. And that's really how we do it. We discover devices, categorize them, and then break down every single transaction that there is. So from a security perspective, I think, as you said, time to insight, time is data in security. The sooner you find something, the lesser the impact.
Now, with 40 gigabit of real-time analytical capacity, I'm assuming that also means that you're doing real-time decryption, because there's going to be a lot of SSL streams in there. There's going to be a lot of encrypted streams. In order to get any intelligence, you need to be able to decode those streams in real time, right?
Absolutely, especially from security. So the gravity and of data that Matt was talking about becomes worse in security, because not only do you have a massive amount of data, but now you're having an increasingly encrypted amount of data. I actually found an interesting study by Zscaler's research lab today that said they found a 400% increase in phishing attacks over TLS compared to last year. So this is increasing dramatically. To make it worse, traditionally, if you're encrypting traffic, you're encrypting them with RSA key exchanges. Now, if you do that and you have the server private key, you can decrypt that traffic without being in band. The problem is, and it's good and bad, is that with the prevalence of perfect forward secrecy, which is Diffie-Hellman key exchanges, you can't decrypt it out of band. So being able to do that is something that we're able to do and at scale. So it's incredibly important.
Let's set some ground rules here, because people are going to listen to that. They're going to say, wait a minute, they're decrypting my encrypted traffic. we're talking about a service and appliance inside of your network. You own this network.
Yes.
And so as an IT person, there should be nothing that's encrypted for me. I should have visibility into everything. Whether or not you trust me, that's on me. But the hardware has to exist so that I could at least have the capability to make sure that what's happening on my network is on the up and up. But, okay, the geek side of me is kind of screaming in my head saying, what kind of hardware do you need to do real-time analysis, decryption of 40 gigabits per second?
So the fun part is, that's what we're optimized for, just like F5 hardware was optimized to be this SSL beast, right? So we're able to decrypt that traffic easily and at scale. Now, the part with PFS in that we're able to get those actual session keys directly from the servers that are negotiating that traffic. So there's actually a bit less overhead in decryption, so we're able to keep up very quickly.
Nice. Okay. Now, this is an open question to both of you. When you come in and you attempt to do an installation, you attempt to do a deployment, what are the most often requested features? What are the pieces of visibility that the IT admin wants, and that's why they're bringing you in?
Sam, you go first. That's a good question.
Active
I'll give you
directory.
All the tough ones.
Oh, yeah. You know, the most popular ones that I've seen, Active Directory. So visibility into what users are doing, as well as the health and well-being of Active Directory, things like time skew errors. That's more of a performance-related issue, but that's definitely one of the larger ones. Visibility to DNS, that's another massive one. Active Directory does not log DNS by default. So if you're not logging every query and response, you're missing a lot, especially from security in terms of DNS tunneling exfiltration. If you're not seeing that, you're missing it. So that's another huge one. File accesses as well, so storage, SIFs. Those are some of the highlights that I can generally see.
Okay, all right.
I'll answer the question a little bit differently and say that many times the expectations coming in on the front side of an opportunity when a customer, they want general visibility, they want insight into the network, and then they're very surprised to see the breadth and depth of the actual protocol coverage and the transactional fluency of those protocols. And so Sam's example of network attached storage is a great one, because there's all sorts of, you know, as a service protocol and Active Directory too, for that matter, both of those things have been largely underserved historically by the vendors in the space, security, monitoring, and otherwise. And service protocols are really the sort of crown jewels of risk in many cases as it relates to file access, sensitive data, usernames, and things like that, as well as performance, these cascading performance problems that spread throughout the environment. So if DNS, say, is another great example by Sam, if DNS is degraded, literally everything suffers, but sometimes catastrophic sort of results. And it's also a huge attack vector for reflection attacks and various forms of DDoS, cache poisoning, and other things. And so typically it comes in a sort of traditional monitoring sense or security sense, as we need more visibility, we need more insights, we need to do it more quickly. And then it turns into something more when they get a full sense of the scope and sort of depth that ExtraHop can address.
Right. We do have actually a question from the chat room, JJ to the 4884. Wants to know about, well, what about encrypted traffic like Tor traffic? I mean, obviously, you're not going to be easily, you don't have the certificates for that. You don't have the keys for that. That just shows up as unknown, or that shows up as, does it verify, oh, yeah, that's a torrent because it's using a weird port going to a weird service?
In many cases, we'll identify the outbound traffic. And in every case, we'll see the certificate handshake. And we will sort of pin the certificate to a specific flow. And the point stands on the outbound on a Tor side, for example, it would drop down to L4 analysis. So we would get up to sort of layer 6 in the SSL, in the sort of encryption handshake. Even with SSH, we can actually look at the handshake stage and get a bunch of insights. Right. And then it would go opaque to us, and you would monitor sort of outbound egress traffic at layer four and things like that. That's also, there are implementation ways to get around that, by the way, and to crack that open via like an egress, like a Palo or something, an egress proxy that can sort of intercept those things and send us decrypted streams. But generally speaking, that's a great observation. For someone else who owns their certificate outside, we would see the handshake and then it would drop to L4 in many cases. We would see the DNS resolution, SSL handshake, and beyond.
And of course, you could see that all in real time. So you could actually set up an alert that, oh, there's a handshake here that's going to happen and I'm about to lose the ability to see the stream. What do you want to do? And that's is that sort of the actionable intelligence that I can use?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, I do want to talk about Addy, because moving from ExtraHop 4.0 to 7.0 was pretty big, and I want to jump in there. But before we get there, just to clear this up for our audience, maybe a question, this could be for Sam. If I had a 10,000-seat enterprise and a typical hybrid setup, so I've got stuff on-prem, I've got stuff in cloud, how do I deploy your solution? What do I need? What kind of hardware do I have to put in? How do I make sure your service is running properly? And how? What's the best practices to make sure I'm collecting intelligence from the right points around my network?
Sure thing. So the ExtraHop platform has a lot of different types of devices, both physical and virtual and cloud. So if you have a hybrid environment, essentially you would deploy us at least initially close to servers so that we can see both north, south, and east, west traffic. East, west comes in very heavily into a security play from a lateral motion reconnaissance type activity. So we want to see that. And then the way we structure that is we size them appropriately and put them where they need to be, and then use a central management console to stitch them all together so you can compare performance and behavior across the multiple types of implementations, cloud, virtual, or physical.
All right. Okay. Now, let's ask the question. I think this actually might be for Matt. Explain the move from ExtraHop 4.0 to 7.0. You made a lot of noise about this. This was actually pretty big, especially bringing in Addy. What makes it different? What is it? What does it do?
All right. So Addy is the culmination. And we actually, you know, launched Addy some time back, but we've been piling on the enhancements. And Addy has a bunch of sort of security-related functionality. Before I get into Addy proper, I'm going to rewind a little bit and say that Addy represents the culmination of a three-year investment on our part in machine learning that was initiated sort of in the belly of the beast at corporate ExtraHop in the dark sort of corners of engineering. Our CFO, Jesse Rothstein, and others have made an investment at that time. And we realized during that journey that not only did we do the real-time stream reassembly and all the stuff that Sam addressed so well, is that another way to think about this is a feature extraction engine. And so when we run this analysis in real time, we're effectively extracting features in ML parlance. And those features and those metrics that we calculate on the fly, those can then feed in an unsupervised machine learning sense. So they can feed Addy, which is our machine learning service. And it's very important because 2016, if you think about it, 2016 was the year of sort of machine learning when it really made its way into the top of the public eye. You're starting to interact with your Xfinity remote in interesting ways. There's Echo and beyond, right? And it made its way, likewise, into enterprise IT. And it's going to continue to grow in prevalence. And this year, we see, is the year of integrations, where we're starting to integrate with third-party systems to do interesting things, which leads us to 2018, which gets into the year of automation. I really think that, and this is a prediction made by one of my coworkers, really smart guy, and I tend to agree, I think that we are already seeing early evidence of this. And Addy, as an overlay of intelligence, think about it this way. Addy is a PhD level data scientist for the cost of a temp worker that's never off the clock working on your behalf, running analysis on petabytes of pre-processed data per day or per week or per hour.
I don't know. I've worked with a lot of PhDs, and they're not always pleasant. Okay. And I understand that point. So I'm using machine learning. I'm using some fantastic analytical tools to take line speed, real-time informatics out of my network, feeding it into the system, and what does it tell me? Give me some best-case scenarios. Me sitting in my data center using ExtraHop service. What do I see? and how does it make my job better and easier?
Sure. Sam, you want to take that one and then I can jump in?
Sure. You know, one of the and again, I'll go back to security a little bit. One of the anomalies that I noticed, which was especially interesting, was the surfacing of a client performing enormous numbers of DNS reverse lookups against the DNS environment. That is the precursor to lateral motion. So that was a massive one that I noticed that we're surfacing.
Yeah, and another example would be, you know, an increase in sort of staying consistent with DNS, an increase in resolution errors or DNS timeout behaviors, which too can be a precursor for security incidents or massive performance impacting lateral movement, TCP state. So an example there would be a retransmission timeout from a performance management perspective in the traditional network performance management space. Addy will proactively surface these events to you and tell you when they happened and how she, and yes, I'm assigning a gender to our machine learning service. How she figures out that this is a retransmission timeout. And in fact, for a given device, you know, we can look at 5,500 servers worth of analysis in real time at 40 gigs. And Addy will say surgically out of the totality of the data center environment, this one host started sending a disproportionate outbound sort of set of retransmission timeouts and impacted this service. And you click on the UI and it takes you right to the device in question for the time period in question when the anomaly was thrown. So you can then take an action on that particular event. It's a very powerful model.
Okay, which one of you wants to walk us through the demo? Because I think actually seeing it will help people understand what kind of intelligence they can get.
Oh, so the video that we have is actually of our second sort of big feature, which is the live activity maps. And we can sort of fire that up whenever you're ready and I can speak to it. So, okay, so we've established and I'll assume for a minute that your listeners collectively take us at face value that we do this full stream reassembly real time. Well, we were faced with the problem of how do we render that data in high context, high resolution, and in a way that's sort of interesting and in real time. And you can see the map just updated and it's protocol fluent. And so this is not simplistic port-based classification. This is actually us doing transaction replay in real time at scale. And here I've filtered down to a specific protocol. And I'm showing you a constellation of activity for SIFs. You can see the four interconnected hosts. The thickness of the edge that connects them represents transaction volume, TCP turns, or data transfer. And I can simply, and notice the little lasers. We added lasers to our product. So the little lasers show the directionality, who's consuming the service and who's serving the service, if you will. And so with a single visual against thousands of systems, I can look at this visually and I click on the edge and notice this is taking me to the transaction log of all of the transactions between those two hosts for just SMB version 2 writes. This includes user access, which resources were accessed, a layer 2 bytes, any TCP level events, and the packets. I'm just clicked into the packets that were replayed statefully in real time. And we've extracted on the top right there, you can see 15,000 packets out of tens of millions. And we surgically extracted that packet stream from many, many different devices represented on the map just for that one network attached storage transaction. So it's a very, very, so what this really represents, guys, is a radical acceleration of traditional performance management, troubleshooting, and security workflows, where we're able to characterize at scale the behaviors in the environment, understand what's happening, directionality, transaction boundaries, volume, turns, and the rest, and then take you right down to the transactions themselves for the individual assets, as well as the packets if you need them. In many cases, you don't, frankly, but if you need the packets, they're there, and you're never more than sort of two clicks away from those things from the main map. And that's the live activity map. Honestly, from a product perspective, this has been a sort of last mile issue that at ExtraHop we've wanted to address for quite some time, which is how do we render our real-time analysis in a dynamic sort of interactive way to get users to their insights as quickly as possible? And we have an amazing team of product management and engineers at corporate that conceived of and in fact delivered the live activity map. And it's been a huge hit with our customers.
We've got two questions out of our chat room. JJ to the 4884 again wants to know, is this cross-platform? So can he use this on Linux, Windows, OS 10? It seems to be browser-based, so it really shouldn't matter, right?
So the user interface, yes, is in fact browser-based, so that won't matter. And I think the question, JJ, we don't discriminate what the server is. We have Windows servers, AS400s in many cases, in mid-range, like in regional banking, for example. We have AIX. We don't really discriminate on the type of server or the type of traffic. And as a browser-based interface, there too, it just kind of works.
Right. And one more question from RJP421 wants to know, in looking at, say, an educational or nonprofit deployment, what kind of pieces would be required? Is this a single appliance that gets dropped into the middle of the network? What has to be added in order to get the best intelligence for the service?
That's a great question. So we work pretty hard to meet different users where they're at from a deployment perspective. So if you have... We have virtual machines that run as native images in VMware. And so you could actually run the entire stack in virtual machine world. If you're in AWS, we could spin up virtual instances in AWS and run there natively too. If you prefer hardware, we've got various size hardware appliances that we would install. You would span the data to us from the network, and then we would start our processing. In many cases, we deploy in an hour or less to start giving you, you know, in fact, sometimes much less than an hour. By the time you get back to your seat and fire up your monitor, you have the live activity map, and we've auto-classified and started auto-discovering all of the characteristic behaviors and transaction types in the environment. It's very powerful.
You've just made a lot of our listeners very happy with being platform agnostic. That's exactly what they want to hear. All right, I'm going to bring my co-host back in here. Chibert, let's start with you. I've watched you fan yourself and kind of get to the edge of your seat for the last 20 minutes. So you've got something that's on the edge of your mind here. What's going on?
Well, I'm starting to see a real need for, desensitizing network tools, diagnostic tools from large amounts of skills necessary to interpret. So I'm starting to see a trend in a lot of network monitoring systems, well, a few network monitoring systems, where they're starting to put in natural language interfaces to make it easier for, say, the third shift to go and ask what's going on to help interpret the data. Are we going to see someday that Addy is going to be able to come up and, you know, just like I can ask Jeeves what's going on or Alexa? Are we going to start seeing some natural language interfaces showing up in Addy someday?
That's a very interesting question. I can't represent the product roadmap. That's sort of beyond my pay grade and my purview. But I can say today, Addy gives you self-described. So it's very sort of contextually rich. Let's take SSH lateral movement as an example. We'll say, hey, here's a server in your environment, and guess what? They're now an SSH client, and this individual at this time connected to these peers adjacent on the 1918 address space. And this is very suspect because, as he says, we've never seen this characteristic behavior before, and that comes right into your inbox sort of proactively as in the form of an alert, and it represents itself in sort of a flashing red light on the extra hop UI. So that's sort of vector A. And then vector B, our dashboarding is very, very strong. And so we have this concept of dashboards being almost like real-time runbooks if they're implemented properly. And so you could dashboard kind of to your heart's content, and then you can ask sort of intuitive questions of the dashboard, like say, hey, show me HTTP 500 errors for this application at L7. For this time, and it'll sort of spit it out. On the NLP side, stay tuned, I would say. That's a very interesting idea.
So I do have a comment and question too as well. So, visibility into network system issues, even, system issues in general when it comes to cloud services is normally pretty paramount when it comes to ensuring reliability of that system. And in the past, these data visibility, these visuals, whether there's dashboards or whatnot, were really for just CTOs and CIOs just to kind of give them some like high level visibility in the systems. But what you're showing is and finding is this is also great for, you know, the IT personnel, as well as deep learning, the network analytics. And, you know, in the past, I've seen that, you know, network forensics as part of that security incident response time is really kind of critical when it comes to making sure that you kind of alleviate that issue, and having this deep visibility into the data and visuals makes it a lot easier. Are you seeing that when it comes to, you know, have you worked with corporations where they've come back and say, hey, our incident response times are down a massive amount because of just getting this visibility into the data?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll, Sam's certainly got perspective on this as well, and I'll take the sort of part one answer to that. That's a very insightful question. And philosophically, I'll ask a rhetorical question, in fact. Why wouldn't the data, that the transactions that are traversing and the state of the network as an asset to the organization, why wouldn't that data be sort of set free across organizational boundaries? From the VP of infrastructure, say, to the application delivery team or the DBAs or the level one NOC themselves. And what we do is we work really, really hard as a company to address that swath of sort of that set of constituents that can and should be able to consume wired data. And the historical solutions in the space have been, there's been way, way too much friction involved to get like a CIO level report on the one hand that's automated and delivered proactively into their inbox. And then, you know, like an incident response team, and to give them the sort of forensic level insight or the troubleshooting for a level 1, 2, 3 escalation path in a network context. So we do cover that swath. Typically we come in where the rubber meets the road with the folks who come hands on keyboards, and then the use cases tend to expand after we establish ourselves in an account. It's very interesting, actually, the sort of the scope that changes as the analysis makes itself available to the org.
Sam, did you have
Sam, any perspective on that?
Yeah, so I also cover commercial, but I also cover defense. So the customers, when you started looking at those live activity maps and the way you can drill down, start to see relationships, and then drill down into the actual transactions, if that looks like a threat hunting workflow, it's because it really is. So the defense folks I've worked with have one unique problem, and that unique problem is immense and quick turnover. They have folks right out of boot who are sent downrange to investigate networks, and they really don't have a whole lot of experience. So one of the great characteristics of our platform was that you notice you didn't type any queries. You're literally clicking around and looking at dashboards. So that visual aspect of it allows them to operationalize folks in their words in 30 minutes of training. And these are folks with very little experience, you know, kids right out of college or out of high school or boot camp.
Sam, I got a quick question here about PFS. So, you know, perfect forward security, that's when an encryption system will automatically change keys so that even if a key is compromised, you only get a very small bit of the communications. This has actually been a big point for ExtraHop, especially as you move to 7.0, especially as you add an ADDIE there. How do you deal with PFS, and why is it important that people understand what ExtraHop does with it?
Sure. The problem with PFS, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is that unless you're in the middle of that conversation, unless there's another solution, which I'll talk about in a second, you're not going to be able to decrypt that traffic. So something east-west traffic that isn't being proxied or intercepted is simply invisible and opaque to the investigators, right? Especially with TLS 1.3, which is going to require PFS. So the way we address it out of band is we actually get that ephemeral secret from the server itself, which is one of the only two parties that actually hold that. So by getting it from there, we can decrypt it while still being out of band.
You know, I'm listening to this. I'm getting very excited. I want to play. But, I'm starting to wonder and scratch my head going, if Equifax had ExtraHop in their operations, do you think we would have had the breach?
It's a good question.
We're not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna take the bait on that one.
Oh come on. If Equifax had someone in the data center with crayons, they probably could have done better. But I mean let's move away from Equifax. Let's say it's something like Equifax. ExtraHop give me the intelligence to not have that massive breach?
So there's different stages, and Sam certainly has perspective on this as well. And so there's the sort of detection stage, investigation, and remediation stage. And I would, my high level answer to that is, without going too far into the weeds and getting into any specifics with companies, is that analysis, given the right analysis that gives you as many insights per unit time as possible with minimal friction, it will help to alleviate all of those afflictions, whether it's the lag time between sort of detection and response, or if it's the detection stage or the investigation post exploit or post incident. And so we look at the end of the day, we've been talking a lot about security, about performance management to us. And I'm sort of representing my former operations self here, is that it's all about operational analytics and situational awareness, regardless of whether it's troubleshooting, of whether it's incident response. It's about getting to an insight quickly and using that insight to inform a decision in a high quality kind of way. And so I think the high order is that, yes, to the extent that you have real-time analytics that you don't have to sort of wrestle with to get at, it'll absolutely help.
Yeah.
Matt, thanks a lot. That was an ambush, and I apologize for that. But I was just listening to this and going, wow, this could have solved my problems with Equifax. And it's like, oh, I wish they had called you guys.
No, but our audience gets it, because we've got Colin EH, who, you know, points out very rightly so that, look, that east to west visibility is huge, and so few do it right. And it's kind of puzzling why we don't do it right, because that would seem like that's step number two in securing your network. Gentlemen, unfortunately, we are out of time. I went over time again, but I do want to thank you for being on. Let me give you some time here at the end to leave our audience with what they need to know. If they are looking at getting some actionable intelligence out of their networks, if they're looking for something that can do line speed, if they're looking for something that can do what looks like magic with other network monitoring tools, what do they need to leave this episode with? What would be your elevator pitch? And I'll let each of you have one. Let's go ahead and start with you, Sam. What's your elevator pitch to the Twilight Riot on why they should at least try ExtraHop?
If you don't see everything, you don't see everything. I would start with.
That's not bad. Yeah.
If you're not looking north, south, east, west, and keeping up with – and that's actually the problem. If you're not keeping up with the massive amounts of data traversing your network in all directions, you're going to miss security. You're going to miss performance. So that's pretty much simple as that. Complete visibility gives you complete operational visibility and intelligence.
Okay. All right. Nice. I like the simplicity of that. I would even go to one step further, and that is, if you're not seeing everything, you're really seeing nothing. But
I like it.
Yeah. All right. And over to you, Matt.
Well, how am I going to follow that? I mean, so I would say it's very similar. You know, are you making data-driven operational decisions? Yes or no? And is that data sourced from an empirical source of evidence like the wire? And is that done in a sort of consumable way across organizational units in the environment? If the answer to that question is no, you really, really do at least need to look at us and consider ExtraHop, because that's the sort of mission that we're set out for, is to sort of set the data from the on the wire free across the organization.
Fantastic. Sam Richman, again, good to see you. I kind of miss not seeing you every year. We got to fix that. When's the next time you're in San Francisco? You have to go come say hi.
Oh, I hope soon. Absolutely. I miss our days greatly. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. And who knows? Maybe we'll create something even better. And also, Matt Cawthorn, both from ExtraHop, both have been a fantastic guest. Thank you very much for dropping knowledge onto the Twilight Riot. You know, some people do complain that sometimes we talk about the same topics over and over again. Well, that's because the same topics are really, really important over and over again. And you've brought something new to the table, and I very much appreciate that. I know you've already had your little elevator pitch, but let me give you one last chance. Where do they go if they want to find out more about ExtraHop? Who should they talk to if they want to demo this on their network? And you know, what are the possibilities for them, say, in the next week or so?
Oh, definitely go to the website, and you can sign up for a free online demo that sort of walks you through the totality of the solution. And it'll give you a very good feel for what that workflow looks like and how you can sort of interact with the data. And it's actually like a full deployment. So it's a very sort of interesting thing that I'm pretty proud of. I think that we have given a lot of value out to folks with that. So I would start there and then just know that we've got a global presence. And so wherever you are, wherever you're listening from, I know this audience is massive. You know, you can reach out to us via online and we can follow up, and we're very sort of POC friendly, and we can give you insights that I can comfortably say we can give you insights you might not expect, and is pretty, pretty valuable. So definitely hit us online.
Sam, Matt, thank you. It has been an absolute pleasure, and thank you for being here on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 Torrent streams running through your enterprise network. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, to my guests and also to my co-hosts. I could not do this show without them. Cheebert, let's start with you. What are you up to other than melting into a puddle of Hawaiian goo? And where can people find you if they want to see your work?
Oh, definitely Twitter. And thank you, JJ. The email from your friend has paid off. We are going to be booking that person for a future show. Deep dive into Linux virtualization. A lot of fun. Anyway, ADVNETLAB on Twitter, or drop me an email at cheebert@twit.tv. I'd love to hear from you. And if all goes well, I'm waiting with bated breath to see how many years the state retirement office gives me back from my split service. I may be able to pull the ripcord and do an official retirement sooner than I thought.
I hope so. If so, hopefully some of your retirement tour can come through California, because we got a party for that.
You betcha.
Laser tag, I think, or mini golf. Geeks party differently, I think. Lou Maresca, also thanks so much to you, my friend, especially since you just got back from Ignite yesterday. By the way, I got to ask, this is totally off the tracks, this is off the rails, but how much of the booth setup and teardown do you have to do, or do you just parachute in, do your thing, and leave?
I parachute in.
Oh, good. Okay. Got it. So you're like the rich person at Burning Man. I got that. Yeah. That's cool. But how are you, my friend, and where can people find you and your work, and maybe even your son who's decorated your room with Batman stickers?
He has. Yeah, obviously, you know, go check out all the Ignite stuff. There's over 640-something sessions available. It's myignite.microsoft.com/videos. All the on-demand stuff's there. Check it out. You know, I'm continually focusing on making developers more productive on top of the Office platform. So there's a ton of sessions there. Check it out. And, of course, you can always find me on twitter.com, @LouMM. You know, where you'll find all my posts. Both my work related as well as kind of my opinion related type stuff. Check it out there all the time.
Lou, Cheebert, thank you so very much once again. And although I there's a good chance that next week I won't be here, you two are going to hold down the fort just because I've got jury duty and I can't count on actually being in the studio. Also, thanks to you, to the person who drops by every single week and watches or listens. We wouldn't have a show without you, and I thank you for all your years of being loyal to the show. Now, we will want to do something for you. We want to make it easier for you to catch up on the episodes that you've missed. Maybe look at the stories that we've covered in every show. You can find it all at our show page, in our show notes at twit.tv/Twyatt. That's This Week in Enterprise Tech. Once you're there, also, why not pay a visit to the little drop-down menu? That's where you can subscribe to the show. You can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version into your device of choice. Maybe even share that link with a friend so that they can subscribe. It's the best way to make sure that we can keep bringing you all the enterprise goodness that you want week after week. Also, thanks to everyone here who makes the show possible, to all the engineers like Burke and John and Alex, who make sure that everything is hooked up properly, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing this show every week, to Kevin, our TD, our wonderful TD, who every week gets a chance to redeem himself by answering a question with knowledge from the show. And Kevin, this week, the question is going to be quite simple, and it's actually in the notes, and I'm actually pointing at it right now in the notes. What does PFS stand for?
Perfect Forward Secretary.
Oh, so close, my friend. Maybe next week.
Perfect Forward Secrecy.
Maybe next week. We'll try again.
Wait,
Unfortunately. Oh, go figure. Until next time, folks, I am Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.